The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
start.
Hard.
4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program as we are zeroing in on Pluto as we speak. It's great to be here on another beautiful San Francisco Bay Area day. I hope wherever you are, it is equally as nice. And we have a great show for you today, so I want to hold our announcements down to a minimum. Of course, I always say that, and I never do, but we'll give it a try. If you want to call and talk to our guest today, who I will introduce in a minute, Al Globus, use 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Let the phone ring, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. And we do hold relevant callers over a break, and also we answer the phone during the break. Remember, we have the one toll-free line, so if I start getting notes from other listeners saying they want to get in on the line, I'll ask you to wind up your call and move on so we can make room for other callers. You can also use email, which is drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So on Sunday, after the Sunday program, we do upload a very detailed website newsletter, and it has all of the program information for the coming week, guest bio information for the coming week, and it also is the only place where we have a future events section as to what's coming up over the next several weeks on the Space Show. So you do want to check it out, and to stay current, you do want to check it from time to time, because we do end up having to change our schedule every once in a while. Guests have changes, I have changes, sometimes we have technical glitches. So if you tune in and you think you're going to hear Joe Blow, and instead you hear Connie Blow, then go check the website newsletter to see what happened, and we probably will have all the details there for you, and when Joe Blow will be rescheduled for the Space Show program. And again, you can't miss the website newsletter. It's in big letters, pretty much in the middle of the Space Show's homepage, thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived on our website and our blog, so you can either download these shows very quickly if you have high-speed internet, or you can listen to them right off of our website. And if you are using the blog for that, remember that you can also post comments and exchange ideas with other listeners, and many times the guests will involve themselves in these discussions as well. And the blog is thespaceshow.wordpress.com. On our website, there's a Space Show store up near the top, and it's called Space Show Gear, so check it out and hope you find some items of interest. Your suggestions and feedback are always welcome. The most important button to me there is, as I say all the time, support the Space Show. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And the only reason we're able to bring you these programs is because many of you do support and contribute to the Space Show, and we thank you for that support very much. Remember that your gift is tax deductible on the federal level. We are a 501c3. And for those of you fortunate enough to pay California taxes, we are a California Public Benefit Corporation, and you get a deduction in California as well. If you have any questions, do visit the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org button or email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Just an update, our crowdfunding program to finance a new website with archival quality archives and have them fully searchable in a library fashion is just around the corner, and I will be having more to say about that after the coming New Space Conference, which is going to be this coming week in San Jose. And if you're there, by the way, find me, look me up, say hello, and introduce yourself to me. Okay? And remember that we're copyrighted and trademarked, and we do let everybody download our programs and share them over the net. If you do actually want to send a program over the net, they're large files, around 40 to 45 megabytes. So if you don't know how to do that, you can ask me, or of course you can just send somebody who you think is interested the URL for the show once it's archived. And there are a couple of rules about that. So one of them is don't do anything commercial with our programs. Number two, really important, don't edit them and don't upload any part of a show or all of a show to YouTube or any other website, including your own, without our written consent. And if you want to find our full copyright disclosure statement on all of this, it's on every page of the Space Show website and the One Giant Leap Foundation website. So just scroll down to the bottom and you'll see our full copyright disclaimer. I'm really easy to reach, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't get yourself in hot water. And if there is a reason for you to want to use a clip from a show or to use a show, just contact us first to find out if it's okay with us, okay? And then the last rule is don't do any written transcripts, even if they're for your own personal use. We do podcasts, and we thank Andrew at gigadial.net for the service. You can find our podcasting RSS URL on our website, both of our newsletters, and we're in iTunes and a host of other places as well. And then finally, remember that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World helps to promote cooperative solutions for space security. And you can get a lot more information about this great organization. Just visit their own website, www.swfound.org. And they also sponsor our webinar series. And we have another sponsor, Tom Driggers, broadcast engineer, lifesaver for 11th hour projects that have gone south in terms of website work and engineering work. His contact information is on the sponsors page at onegiantleapfoundation.org and the Space Show site. And he's been with us for 13 out of our 14 years. And I can't recommend him enough for your work. And that brings me to today's program. So the last time our guest, Al Globus, was on the show was August 4th, 2008. Way, way too much time has passed. But he has been a busy guy since then. So Al's bio is up on the website, so you can actually read about him. But a couple of highlights. He has worked on projects as a NASA contractor over at Ames on Hubble, ISS, X-37, Shuttle, Earth Observation, Teleoperation, Molecular Nanotechnology, Asteroid Mining, Bone Development, and Micro-G, and a lot more. He started the contest for 6th to 12th graders on space settlement. We'll get updates with him on that. And I think he's the founder of that. He's published a lot of papers, and he has realized and published about, and I don't know if discovered is the right word, but maybe it is the right word, that putting settlements in low Earth orbit, especially over the equator, is a hell of a lot easier than everyone thought in terms of radiation and mass. And he will talk about that when we bring him on the program. I urge you to read his full bio on the program. And we are very happy to bring back to the show Al Globus. So, Al, welcome back. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. And it's great to be back on your show. This is a great show.
Thank you. And you're still a NASA contractor, right?
Yes, I am.
And still at Ames, right?
Still at NASA Ames, which is a great center.
And is it still a great center with the new director? I know that's a loaded question.
Yeah. Eugene Tu is a good guy. I don't think he's going to be as wild as Pete has been, but he's a good guy, and everything has gone just fine since he took over.
Pete's wildness was really endearing. Everybody kind of loved it, right?
Yeah, no, I'm using wild in the best possible sense.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's talk space settlement, okay? So isn't space settlement, it's usually thought of as we're going to go to Mars or maybe on the moon possibly or maybe an asteroid, but not, it's not usually thought of as 500 miles above Earth over the equator. Or am I wrong?
Yes. When you say space settlement, most people think of Mars or maybe the moon. But there have been proposals in front of us since the 70s to build space settlements in orbit, sometimes called free space settlements because they're in free space. And the central discovery, and it really was a discovery and unexpected, that has led to me being on your show, is that it turns out that building space settlements, free space settlements, is hundreds of times easier than we thought it was, if you use mass as a proxy for difficulty. And not only is it hundreds of times easier with respect to mass, it's also hundreds of times easier with respect to distance. Because it turns out that right around 500 kilometers, not miles, kilometers, orbits pretty close to directly above the equator don't get a whole lot of radiation. And because they don't get a lot of radiation, you don't need much radiation shielding. As a matter of fact, you might not need any at all in those orbits. And radiation shielding is 95 or more percent of the mass of a typical free space settlement design. So that reduces the mass enormously. Also, moving your settlement to 500 kilometers from Earth makes resupply from Earth an awful lot easier. It's about 760 times closer than lunar orbit, which is where most free space settlement designs were placed. And the reason that they were placed there was to use lunar materials for radiation shielding. And there's two aspects to that. One is the amount of shielding that they thought was enough was not. It's about half of what's actually necessary. And second, the reason, the whole reason for putting a settlement there was to get lunar materials, to make it easy to move materials from the moon. But if you don't need shielding, and it's most of your mass, then the need to be close to the moon goes away. The other big discovery was really a matter of interpreting the data. In order to provide artificial gravity to the inhabitants of a space settlement, in design, one rotates the settlement. And you can provide 1G so your kids will grow up with nice, strong bones and muscles, which will not happen on Moon or Mars, because gravity's too weak. It has always been thought, since back in the 70s, that one or maybe two revolutions per minute is as much as you could do without people getting sick. You know, if you sit in a chair, in a rotating chair, and you rotate very rapidly, you'll get ill. Well, it's true, if you rotate rapidly, you will get ill, but not for very long, depending on how fast you rotate. And in fact, you can go 4, maybe even 6 RPM, and that radically shrinks the size of the settlement. So not only do you not need, you know, 95, 98, 99% of the mass for radiation shielding when you move to low Earth orbit, you can spin faster, and that makes your whole settlement smaller. So instead of having a settlement that's a kilometer across, or half a kilometer across, you can have a settlement from a rotation perspective that's maybe 100 meters in diameter or 50 meters in diameter. That corresponds to 4 revolutions per minute and 6 revolutions per minute. Well, it's a whole lot easier to build something that is 100 meters across than to build something that is 500 meters across or 1,000 meters across, depending on whether you're rotating at 1 or 2 RPM. But that does hide another issue, is if you can rotate this fast, and it's okay, people won't get sick, or more accurately, the visitor might feel a little ill for the first day or so, particularly at 4 RPM. At 6 RPM, it's a little worse. But a resident will have adapted years ago, because you can adapt to 4 RPM in, you know, a few hours or a day. You know, it's a little like if you're going to visit the you know, Kathmandu, you may get altitude sickness for a day or two. When you go there, you may want to just lay down for the first day. You know, have a couple of meals and just take it easy, because otherwise your altitude sickness will kick in and bad things will happen. Similarly, if you visit a space settlement that's rotating at 4 or 6 RPM, you might want, you know, have the assumption you're going to feel a little queasy for a couple of hours or maybe a day, or at 6 RPM, maybe even 2 days, unless you're particularly susceptible. But that's okay for residents, and it's even okay for visitors. I mean, it's not great, but it's not a showstopper. And what that means is there are other factors that determine the smallest size settlement. And to tell the truth, we don't know what those factors are.
Let me ask you a question. Is there anything in terms of economic value, purpose, or usefulness that a station at 500 kilometers has or does not have in comparison to one near the moon?
Well, in the 70s, the studies done by Princeton physicist Gerard O'Neill, particularly the studies at Stanford and at Ames Research Center, they identified solar power satellite construction as the economic rationale. So the idea was you would put this, you know, large settlement, the one they designed there was called the Stanford Torus, and it's almost 2 kilometers across because it rotates at 1 RPM. You put that at L5, and you launch material with an electromagnetic mass driver from the moon after you have a mining operation on the moon, and you take that material and you turn it into solar power satellites. Then you move those solar power satellites from L5 to a geosynchronous orbit, and they provide power from Earth, and that's how you get your money. Now, at 500 kilometers, it's also not an unreasonable place to put together solar power satellites. You don't need the whole lunar mining bit. You'd like to get it later, but you don't need it at first. And you could assemble satellites, solar power satellites, and then move them into geosynchronous orbit or wherever they went. You could also have a certain amount of tourism, people that would want to visit to go to space because they wanted to go to space. They did not necessarily want to live there, although there are better orbits for tourists, which I can talk about later. But the real business, in my mind, of space settlement is real estate. What you're really doing is building new land. And so the most important economic activity, in my view, of these settlements will probably be building more settlements and selling them to the next generation of space settlers. Now, it could be that in the meantime, this is going to take a while, we may discover products that can be built in space that cannot be easily built on Earth. And some sort of business may develop to build those things and ship them down to Earth. You know, that's where your market is. But we don't know what those products might be. We'd like to encourage research on the ISS and elsewhere to figure out what those products ought to be, but I can't pin them on, say, oh, yeah, this is the product that we're going to be able to sell.
So you have a related question. In fact, you've probably already answered it, but I'm going to ask it anyway because mm-hmm. It's a different approach to the same question I asked. So Bijan is listening over in Sweden, mm-hmm. and he said, why should people settle space in LEO? There are no physical resources there. It is not a waypoint to anywhere else. And if radiation and simulated gravity is the same as on Earth, then why not stay on Earth? Isn't the essence of spaceflight to explore exotic places?
If what you want to do is explore, and what does an explorer do? Explorer goes somewhere, finds out some stuff, and comes back and tells us about it. If what you want to do is explore, then this is not your gig. Okay? It might be helpful in the sense that when Lewis and Clark started their expedition, they didn't start in Washington, D.C., or Boston, or New York. They started it in St. Louis, right? Because it was a nice, well-developed system to get from St. Louis, from the East Coast to St. Louis. They didn't have to build the railroads. They didn't have to build the roads. They didn't have to feed the cattle, the oxen or the horses. They didn't have to, you know, make the carriages and so forth as such. So what they wanted to do was start from St. Louis. Now, settlements at 500 kilometers Leo, or about there, can play the same role as St. Louis with respect to exploration. In other words, if you have a whole industry developed around supplying and operating, say, 30 or 40 or 50 or 100 settlements in low Earth orbit, then your expeditions, you know, to be like Star Trek, can start there rather than start in Florida. And that will make things considerably easier because it's about 10 kilometers per second delta V between the surface and 500 kilometers. But if all you really want to do is explore, then this is overkill. You know, you can get around it some way, okay? I'm not that interested in the exploration. There's nothing wrong with it. There's nothing right with it. But what I'm interested is settlement, permanent settlement of space, moving life, civilization, and humanity, expanding it beyond the surface of the Earth. And not just to visit, but to stay. And that's a completely different thing than exploration. Now, if what you're really interested in is exploration, the big one you got to answer is, why bother with the people? They're fragile. They die a lot. They get sick. They get their bones and muscles atrophy. You're probably better off for most sorts of exploration with robots. I mean, explorers, what do? One of the things they do is make maps. Well, there's no question that robots are better at making maps than people are. Way better. Okay? We have fantastic maps of Mars and the Moon, all produced by robots. Almost, you know, no humans on the ground, you know, dealing with them. If what you really care about is exploring Mars and finding out if there's life there, you send astronauts, and there's going to be tons of life all over the place, but it's all going to be Earth life. There are most of the cells in your body are not you. They are mostly bacteria. And there are 10 or 100 times more virus particles than there are bacteria. As soon as you put people on Mars, there's going to be Earth bacteria and viruses everywhere near that base. And it's going to be very difficult to tease out any life, Martian life, that may be there from all of that noise, okay?
Uh-huh.
But the central point is, I'm not talking about exploration. I'm talking about settlement, permanent living in space.
Okay, so I have a question for you. I need you to help me connect the dots, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So we have known for a very long, long time, I don't know how long, but not as long as I'm old, but a long, long time, that radiation around where the ISS is, which is kind of within that 500-kilometer thing, although it's not always over the equator, is still partially shielded, you know, by Earth, and we're within inside the Van Allen belt, so it's not nearly as big a deal as when you go beyond Leo by any means. So what is significant, help me to see what is significant about saying we now know that we don't have a lot of radiation issues if we're over the equator. I mean, we've known that radiation is not nearly the problem like where the ISS is and within low Earth orbit as it is as you go further out and beyond the Van Allen belts.
Because above the equator has far less radiation than in the ISS orbit. I'll look up the numbers, but it's an order of magnitude or greater. And you can see this in our paper, our rotation paper that's on the web. I'm actually looking for the thing right now. It's Now, here's the thing is most of the radiation that the astronauts experience in the ISS comes from the South Atlantic anomaly.
I was just going to ask you where you are compared to the South Atlantic anomaly.
Well, the South Atlantic anomaly doesn't extend to the equator.
Okay.
It or just the very fringes of it do. And as a result, here I'm getting the data, you know, directly in front of me. The total amount of radiation at 90 degrees, you know, a polar orbit, is about 30 times more than in an equatorial orbit at 0 degrees. And it's about actually 90 times less than at 30 degrees, which is a sort of a maximum. The South Atlantic anomaly is where you get almost all your radiation dosage, and if you stay close to the equator, you miss it. You just don't get it. That assumes it doesn't change much, okay? And that is the reason that you can put a settlement in low Earth orbit and experience relatively, you're still in space, relatively low radiation environment. So low that there is good reason to believe, although it needs to be verified, there's good reason to believe, based on computational studies that we did, that you don't need any radiation shielding or very, very little the shielding that would be provided by the Hall anyway.
Now, who is we when you said we did?
Joe Strout and I did this study, and we did it with a program, a web front end called Olteris. Olteris is provided by NASA, maintained by NASA, and it is a web front end to very sophisticated radiation codes that sit behind it. So you can go in as a novice, you know, just learning about radiation, and you can run these simulations and find out things, which is exactly what happened. We originally went in to just look at radiation for space settlements in general, and we're completely surprised by the discovery that there's this region in space just above the equator, 500-600 kilometers, 400 kilometers and down, something like that, that you don't need any radiation shielding. It's a very surprising result to us.
Okay.
In retrospect, it's obvious, but most things are obvious in retrospect.
All right, so I'm still playing connect the dots with you. So we have various satellites that are above the equator. All of them, of course, I'm talking about are higher than 500 kilometers. But they're not in such radiation-free or very low zones like geosatellites and other stuff. They're all protected. So what is the is 500 kilometers the threshold, and then why does radiation start coming back above 500 kilometers?
Well, if you stay over the equator, the lower you are, the less radiation there is. Okay?
Okay.
And because what's protecting you is Mother Earth.
Right.
Mother Earth creates a magnetic field, and that magnetic field protects you, and it is particularly effective at protecting you if you stay over the equator, because you don't pass through the South Atlantic anomaly. Right. So at 400 kilometers, it's going to be less than at 500. At 600 kilometers, it's going to be more. And we quantified that in our paper for 500 and 600 kilometers, because that's kind of where the break is, where all of a sudden you need almost no shielding, or perhaps no shielding at all, is between 500 and 600 kilometers. Caveat, in 1977... When you look, and you can use Olteris, knows about this, when you look at radiation in space, it depends a great deal on solar activity. The more solar activity, electromagnetic activity, that if it's stronger, it pushes the galactic radiation away from the sun, and so you have less radiation in Earth orbit. We chose at 1977, a time when activity, solar activity, was very low, because we wanted to be conservative in the numbers that we got. So these are pretty close to worst-case numbers. Most of the time, if you look at the actual radiation in space, it will be less than we have in our paper. Okay? So basically, we're just getting the magnetic field of the Earth is protecting us. If we just get a little bit off the equator, more than about 8 or 9 degrees, maybe 7 degrees, then we start passing through the South Atlantic anomaly, and we get dosed, and all that advantage goes away.
What's the name of your paper so people can find it?
It's called, let's see, I forgot to bring, if you search for it, I think it's, sorry, give me a moment. I thought I brought everything up that I would need to say, but I didn't. Okay, it's Orbital Space Settlement Radiation Shielding.
Orbital. So if they Google for that, they can find it.
Yes. Or, if they Google for Al Globus Space or Al Globus Space Settlement, they'll find the page that has a link to it.
Or Al Globus Space Settlement?
Yeah.
Okay, so you want, like, Jeff Greeson, I'm just throwing that name out at random, because he's always a very eloquent and passionate and outstanding speaker on space settlement, as we all know.
Yes.
But he didn't talk about space settlement 500 miles above the Earth's equator.
500 kilometers.
500 kilometers, right. So, but you also want space settlement, but you're picking getting started as a starting point at this point above the equator only because it's the easiest way to get started. Am I getting it right with you?
Exactly. It's easier because you don't need any shielding mass, so that reduces the mass enormously, and it's close. It's easier to do things close than further away. The moon is 760 times further away than a 500-kilometer orbit. Mars, on a really good day, is 100,000 times further away. And that creates all kinds of difficulties. Communication delay, you can only resupply every 6 months, and so forth and so on. That doesn't mean we don't want to colonize Mars. It doesn't mean that we don't want to settle the moon. It means that we want to do, it's just too hard to get started. Get started with the easiest thing that really works, that really gives you some permanent people in space. And if you can make things close, and if you can make things small, then that is a huge win. If you make them a lot closer and a lot smaller, and this proposal is a lot smaller and a lot closer.
Okay, question for you from Jack in Helena, Montana. David, I don't have access to use a telephone, so I'm sending you this email note. It seems to me, Al, that if you are right, that putting a settlement at 500 kilometers above the equator is within the realm of a private sector venture without government assistance, including the choice of a launcher, because you would probably not need a heavy lift launcher like SLS or even Falcon Heavy to pull this off. Why, therefore, have we not seen some innovative entrepreneurial space settlement private group pick up on this and go for it?
The first thing is, this discovery was made a few months ago. And that means that only a few people even know it exists. Not all of them necessarily believe it, or most of them have not read the paper, okay? And it takes time for an idea to percolate to the point that somebody's going to want to invest. Now, that's the first answer. The second answer is this is not particularly easy to do. It's much easier. You don't need a lunar mining thing. You don't need to go to lunar orbit. You don't need, millions of tons of material. But you do need thousands of tons of material, depending on how you look at it. There actually are designs for less than 1,000 tons of material. Actually, let me get those numbers right up in front of me. So here we go. So it's actually the smallest one we're looking at is about 70 tons for the space settlement. That's the smallest estimate. That's still a lot. Okay, that's not easy to do. I think there is a private industry path to get us to a space settlement, but it doesn't start with building a space settlement. It starts with building space hotels. And the reason for that is that there is a huge market for space tourism if the price is right and it's not too dangerous. And when I mean huge market, I mean hundreds of thousands of trips per year. Okay? Now, you do have to get the price pretty low to get to that. But there is an existing tourism market right now. The Russians have flown 8 or 9 people on a pay-as-you-go basis for $20, $30, $40 million. Current price is $50 million, which is probably a little too high. So let's suppose that somebody builds a space hotel and manages to make a profit. Somebody else is going to build another space hotel. And if he can make a profit or she can make a profit, somebody will build another hotel. Now, the larger the hotel, the more attractive it is as a place to move around, and the more guests it can accommodate, so the more money it can make and the more attractive it is. So if you start getting an industry of building hotels in space, they are going to get bigger and more sophisticated. Furthermore, there is an economic driver that says you need to recycle your air, you need to recycle your water, you need to deal with the human waste. All of these problems that we need to deal with in order to build a settlement, all, well, not all, but many, many of the big problems have to be dealt with by hotels as well. But that can be done incrementally at a profit. In other words, you could build a hotel that's just a little bit better than the other hotels. You can charge 10% less or whatever, and you'll get more takers, and you'll make more money. And there's a whole, if you sort of have an industry that is driving this, it's completely plausible to think that you can have hotels on the order of 100 meters across, which incidentally is about the size of the International Space Station. But the International Space Station is sort of linear, one line. It's not a torus or a cylinder or some useful shape. It's also reasonable to assume that some hotels will rotate a little bit to get you some artificial gravity. Probably not 1G. A lot of what you want to do is float around. But it takes a lot of training to learn how to use a micro-G toilet. And if you can spin your settlement up fast enough that you don't need that training, that takes another barrier out of the way of sending more tourists to your hotel. So here we have a situation over a period of development where we have hotels the size of the space settlement we want rotating at somewhat lower speed. So all you need to do, and it has life support, it has oxygen regeneration, it has wastewater handling, it may be growing its own food. Because when you go on your dream vacation into space, you probably don't want to eat freeze-dried crap. There is a problem that the food you will be eating was literally grown from crap, but I will leave that to the marketing guys to deal with. Okay? All you have to do at this point is reinforce the structure to the point where it can rotate fast enough to get 1G, and now you have a settlement because you can raise your kids and they will be strong. They will be able to visit Earth and go see, you know, Dad's workplace, birthplace, or, you know, if they're a great violinist, they can play Carnegie Hall, or if they're a great athlete, they can compete in the Olympics, okay? All things you will never do if you grow up on the moon or Mars. Okay? And now we have a space settlement. We have the first space settlement, and that's just the very beginning.
June in Tucson, Arizona, another email, says the early history of settlements in America is that most of them grew up with some sort of an economic purpose and geographically located near something that could serve them economically. So I still don't understand, other than for passion and space cadet fever and enthusiasm, what will the purposes be of space settlements, regardless of where they're located?
Many settlements were created for the reasons she says. I assume June is a woman.
Right, I think so too.
Not all of them. For instance, the Pilgrims did not go to Massachusetts for economic reasons. They went there for religious reasons. Okay, and then they created an economy once they got there. I have a distant relative who was an indentured servant in the Carolinas who ran away from his indentured service and founded a small town in Georgia, what is now Georgia. He didn't go there because it was economical. He went there to get away from being a temporary slave. So we do not need to satisfy everybody. We only need to satisfy some people. And to be quite honest, space settlement is going to be very hard in the early days to sell to people who are not somewhat fanatical about space settlement. Fortunately, there are a lot of people like that. And as evidence, I provide what Mars One claims. Let's assume that what they said is true, that 200,000 people applied to go one way to Mars on an incredibly risky trip. And many of those people, all of those people created a video, and many of those people paid a fee, 200,000 people. Now, what I'm proposing is infinitely safer and easier, well, not infinitely, but a lot easier and safer than going to Mars. It is not a one-way trip. If you go to your 4 RPM settlement at 500 kilometers and you just hate it, you get on a shuttle and you go back. You probably lose a lot of money unless you can sell your condo or whatever you have to the next person, but you will not be trapped there for life. Okay? And we don't need that many people to get started. The first settlements will probably be on the order of a couple hundred people. Okay? So it is okay for the first settlements to go there for non-economic reasons. They do need some economy when they get there. Oh, another example, the Israeli kibbutzim. Before the creation of Israel, this is something that, you know, Jews would get together and they would, you know, they'd leave mostly Europe, and they would, you know, buy some land and some water rights, and then they would go in there and fortify it because the neighbors were not happy that they were there. And they settled the space. Here are all these settlements created with no real economic justification. They were there because the Jews wanted a place to go where they couldn't be exterminated. They weren't aware that they were going to be exterminated at the time, but eventually it turned out that was the issue. Okay, so lots of settlements have been created that were not driven by economics, although obviously they need to deal with the economics sooner or later.
Another email from Adrian in San Diego. I don't know why these people are not using the phones today. So he has a graph, which I can't read to you over the phone for obvious reasons. But he says it is documented that there has been a steadily weakening of Earth's magnetic field that is currently ongoing, and that it was likely twice as strong during Roman times. As this seems to anticipate the field going to zero and then a polar reversal taking place in some period of time to complete back to another higher level, what are these settlements going to do when without shielding, no magnetic field exists to protect them, a mass exodus back to below the atmosphere for protection? I think this concept needs to be better thought out. Adrian in San Diego.
If the Earth's magnetic field significantly worsens, then the people in these settlements will get more radiation. Now, there's a couple of ways to deal with it. One is you may find that that's acceptable. Okay, the level that we have looked at, that we determined from our studies, was 20 millisieverts per year for adults. We also have a thing about embryos and fetuses, but I'm going to leave that out for simplicity. It's in the paper. So we looked at the literature and, you know, what's going on and how much radiation there was on Earth and so forth and so on, and we thought a reasonable level is 20 millisieverts per year. Now, the background radiation in the United States is 3.1 millisieverts per year, but that's the average. There are many parts of Earth where the radiation levels are quite a bit higher. In fact, there are large parts of Europe, particularly in Spain and Finland, where the level of radiation is 10 millisieverts. Background radiation today, people have lived there for thousands of years and they seem to be fine. Okay? There are a few places on Earth, in Iran, Brazil, and China, where the level of radiation exposure background is far, far higher than 20 millisieverts per year. And as far as we can tell, those people are fine. So, The first thing is, if we get those settlements up there and we take advantage of the magnetic field between now and 2,000 years from now, which would be Roman times, you know, if we've lost half between Roman times and now, let's assume for the sake of argument, then the next 2,000 years we'll lose another 50%. We may be able to handle that just fine. It may be okay. We don't know, but once we're in orbit, we can find out. That's the first answer. The second answer is if, as it weakens, you may say, oh, my God, we need shielding. So you start importing large amounts of shielding from the moon. But we didn't have to build that lunar mine before building the first space settlement. In fact, if you build space settlements in these LEO orbits, you provide a market for lunar materials, and that makes it much easier to build lunar mines. If you look at the business plans of the asteroid mining companies and the lunar mining companies, the weak link in every one of them is the market. Because you definitely want to sell stuff in space. It's very difficult to have lunar or asteroidal materials compete on the ground, to get them onto the ground and compete with terrestrial sources. That's very hard to do. And the only market today in space is robots who are not designed to be refueled and they are not designed to be refurbished, and three people on the ISS, which in due course will be six, and maybe in a couple it would be seven. Those markets are tiny. There is room for about 40 space settlements in 500-kilometer orbit. That's if you assume you space them 1,000 kilometers apart. Now, that spacing may not be a good spacing. That's not well analyzed. But if you have 40 settlements in that orbit, and then you go to 550 and 450, so you can talk about maybe 100 settlements. Now, the initial settlements you want to build as small as you can. So that might be 50 to 100 meters across, depending. But very quickly, you want to start building larger settlements because people like to live in large groups. That's just a fact. So one can imagine very easily, in not too terribly long, maybe 10,000 people per settlement in 100 settlements or so. That's about 1 million people. That's a much bigger market than three. Okay? So one can easily imagine that the creation of these settlements will create a market which will drive the development of lunar mining. Once you have lunar mining, then you can start thinking about providing lunar materials for shielding. The original idea back from the 70s. It's just we got there by a different path, a smoother path. Back in the 70s, the idea was we would get an enormous pile of government money, and we would build these settlements, and then we would start paying building solar power satellites to pay it back. What I am proposing is we start with small little steps, building hotels in space, working our way up over probably a couple of decades to building settlements in low Earth orbit. Now, if the magnetic field starts weakening at a significant rate, and 1,000 years is not a significant rate, okay, then there are a couple of things we can do to deal with it. In the worst case, of course, you put everybody in a shuttle and you bring them home and you went, you know something? Roanoke didn't work and neither did this.
Okay, you have a caller on hold. So
okay.
Let's shift to that. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
Oh, this is Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, originally I called to ask about the what sort of model were you using to gauge the maximum amount of radiation, and it sounds like you're going with the linear node threshold. Is that correct?
I'm using Ulteris. And in terms of what's acceptable, the level we're saying is 20 millisieverts a year. So it's less than 20 sieverts a year. That's saying, okay, the amount of the damage will be acceptable, we think. If it's more than 20 millisieverts, as measured back in 1977, then we're saying, no, this is unacceptable. Obviously, that is somewhat arbitrary, and maybe the true level, depending on what you mean by acceptable, is 30 millisieverts, or maybe it's 15 millisieverts. But in the paper, there's a justification for the 20 millisievert level, and the guts of the justification are the ICRP, the International Commission on Radiological Protection, recommends 20 millisievert per year above background threshold, above background, for radiation workers. On the average in the U.S., that would be 23 millisieverts, but we're just going with 20. And I have one reference, so I'm not sure it's true, but I have one reference that says that the Japanese government allows people back into their homes from the Fukushima nuclear disaster when the level reaches around 20 millisieverts per year.
That is about the linear node threshold because I think the lifetime dosage is around 1,000 millisieverts.
Yeah, but you're never going to get there if you're only getting 20 millisieverts a year.
Yeah. So I know that the I think the Society of Radiologists, they've been trying to get that changed. They're trying to get that standard looked at again.
Yeah.
But if you got places in Iran, and I've heard about these places, and they get around like 250 millisieverts per year. So
the measured level with a little radiological thing put on a person is 132 milligrays per year. That's not adjusted for biological effectiveness. But, you know, it's enormous. The amount of radiation is enormous, and they seem just fine.
Now, how much shielding would it be if we discovered that we could go up to that level without any significant problems?
Oh, what level are you talking about?
The levels that you would see in those places in Iran, the 250 millisieverts per year. What sort of shielding are you looking at?
Well, let's see. Let me look at. I mean, obviously, you could probably go into deep space. Let me look at our data. Well, let's see. If you assume polyethylene, we only go down to 1 ton in terms of the data that we've produced, and that's 193 millisieverts per year if you have 1 ton of polyethylene shielding per square meter of hull. For water, it's 199 millisieverts. So we could get by, if you assume your threshold is 200 millisieverts, it looks like you could probably get by with 1 ton of polyethylene or water shielding. You'd need quite a bit more lunar regolith. You'd need about 5 tons of lunar regolith because lunar regolith is not a particularly good shielding material.
If you got lunar colonies, the best shielding because it's there and you'll have to lift it from the Earth's gravity well.
Right. If you're on the surface of the moon, there's a whole different the moon or Mars. It's a whole different set of arguments. It's very difficult to compare directly. Mass and transportation. Obviously, it's harder to get the stuff that you can't do locally into place. But on the other hand, if you can figure out how to process the local materials, you get a big win. The reason that I'm not particularly interested in the Moon and Mars as an initial location for space settlement, I'm not talking about the long term, I'm talking about the first few, is because your kids will grow up in a low-gravity environment, and they will, I don't know everything that's going to happen to them, but I can say with absolute certainty they will have weak bones and they will have weak muscles, and there's really no way around it. And that, to me, is unacceptable. Other people may find it acceptable. I don't.
Well, it sounds like to me like the only place that we could possibly colonize is the O'Neill-type colonies and a terraformed Venus. That seems like the only places in the solar system we could go to if that's the criteria.
That's the criteria at first. Now, 20 generations down the line, one can imagine experimenting and say, okay, we're gonna have a colony at 0.9 G, and we're gonna see how it goes. And we're gonna work our way down to Martian levels, say. You know, and have a major program of figuring out, really understanding the physiological basis of what's going on. I'm just talking about the first wave of settlement, not what happens 1,000 years from now or even 100 or 150 years from now, but rather what's that easiest first step that will get an acceptable first settlement. And, you know, once you build one, you probably build some more about the same place, about the same way, maybe a little bigger.
Okay. Have you looked into active shielding?
I haven't looked into it in any detail, but basically what my proposal is to use active shielding. It's just you're using the active shield that is already there. You don't have to produce it, right? But it's a little hard to compare active shielding concepts. Obviously, the mass is much, much lower. You need a bunch of power. You have to worry about, you know, it has all kinds of system implications and so forth and so on. So it's a difficult comparison to make. And nobody pays me to do this, so I have limited amount of time to spend on it.
Tim, I understand.
Anything else, Tim, or I'm going to move on to another set of questions?
Oh, one more thing about the... I've actually talked to some earlier guests about this, but one idea I had for dealing with the lower gravity, this is for explorers that would go to, let's say, Mars, mm-hmm. is to wear weighted clothing. I mean, I looked on the internet and there's like these exercise vests that you could wear that weighs about 100 pounds.
Right.
On Mars, it would be about 40 pounds, but that extra mass would keep some of the loading on your bones when you're not out and doing EVA activities.
Right. Exploration is not settlement. They are different things. They have different requirements, and you come up with completely different solutions. That may be a great solution for Martian exploration. But settlement has a radically different set of requirements. For example, so it has to support kids, not just adults. And the amount of time is much longer. You know, even a pretty long Martian exploration mission is on the order of 3 years. In a settlement, where the idea is to have at least some residents who live there for decades.
And I think the big concern would be fetus development in lower gravity.
I don't know that the fetus. I'm not sure. I'm not at all sure. But I don't think the gestation period is a big problem because the fetus is in a liquid environment. It's sort of like being underwater, anyways. Maybe I'm wrong about that. I mean, maybe gravity is a major issue. It's certainly something that needs to be looked at.
I think it was already looked at. The Russians, I believe, took rats up into space and let them. And allow them to develop inside the womb. And when they were delivered, when they were born, they had no sense of balance at all.
I wouldn't be surprised. I know that rodents born in zero G tend to mostly die. And the reason that they apparently die is they starve to death because they have a hard time latching on to mama's nipple in order to get milk. One of the things is that in orbit, you're exposed to both radiation and rotation. So it's hard to say which of those things is causing a particular effect. I mean, you can make hypotheses and so forth, but you don't have data that says, oh, this was caused by gravity, this was caused by radiation. So what we really need is we need a centrifuge, a rodent centrifuge on the ISS, or maybe a Bigelow station, so that we can disentangle the effects of weightlessness from radiation and get an idea what's going to happen. Because, I mean, we certainly don't want to try a human pregnancy at 500 kilometers orbit until we have done lots and lots of rodent pregnancies and see how they go. That is a minimum that we want to do before we start experimenting with people.
Tim, I got to move on. So if it's slow, call back, okay?
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Sure thing.
One more email before I take a break with you.
Okay.
Is again from our friend Bijan in Sweden. Except for Apollo, hasn't all human spaceflight in the world focused on LEO already during 60 years? Do you have any idea about how the resources which are today invested in having humans in LEO should change in order to create a space settlement?
What I think we want to do, and this incidentally is National Space Science Space Society policy and Alliance for Space Development policy. I think what we want to do is to first augment and eventually replace the ISS with a number of privately owned commercially operated space stations. And the way that we want to get there, I think, and this is NSS policy, is have NASA provide partial funding for the development of two or three or maybe four stations, and then those ones who are successful become an anchor tenant. In other words, do the same thing that was used to develop the Falcon 9. The Falcon 9 and the Orbital Sciences Vehicle, and it used to be Kistler because they didn't make it, they were all given partial funding by NASA. If you get to the, you know, the PDF, the PDR, you get so much money. If you have your first test article engine fire, you get so much money and so forth. So NASA provided them with expertise, facilities, and not enough money to do the job, but a good sized chunk of money to develop the vehicle, and then saying, if you succeed and you can deliver supplies to the International Space Station, then we will pay you at this rate to do it. And that is the money that developed, not all of the money, but a sizable chunk of the money that developed the Falcon 9. Now, we want to take that same approach to replacing to augmenting first and then replacing the International Space Station. And I've forgotten the original question, but that's the basic idea, is to make those steps and get into a commercial mode where people can take that same vehicle that they built to be a space station. And if you take that same facility and conceptually remove the space the science equipment, so you have more room to play around, now you have a hotel.
So his question was, given that we've already been doing LEO, and that's been our focus for 60 years, do you have any idea about how those resources, which are today already invested in having humans in LEO, would change in order to do what you're talking
about? Well, what I'm suggesting is that we change it by replacing the International Space Station, augmenting and replacing the International Space Station with privately owned, commercially operated stations that then subsequently morph into hotels. Probably another actual facility, but they use the same technology. Now, here's a lot of people go, oh, we've been in low Earth orbit for so and so many years. Well, you know something. After the Pilgrims, settled Boston, they, 60 years later, they didn't go, oh, we don't care about Boston. I mean, we're just going to leave Boston, and we're all going to go to Kentucky or Ohio or Wyoming or whatsoever. No. Boston kept developing. It kept developing and getting bigger and stronger, okay? And the same with the other, East Coast sites. Similarly, by all means, if you want to go beyond LEO and do exploration, go beyond LEO and do exploration. That's fine. But don't confuse that with settlement. We do not have any settlements in low Earth orbit. Okay? We have 3 people right now. That's not an industrial civilization. That's not a settlement. That's, some fur trappers, running around getting beavers in Montana, what I'm interested in personally, and this is just personally, anybody can have any, what they want. If what you want is exploration, that's fine. But me personally, I want settlement. I want industrialization. I want large numbers of people in space. And the place I believe to do that, to get started, not to end, but to get started, is in low Earth orbit for the reasons that I've described.
Okay, everybody, sit tight. We are way beyond the halfway point of the show today, so we're going to go take our break and pause right here. And we'll be back with Al in a couple of minutes. So, again, don't go anywhere. And our toll-free number, for those of you that want to use it, 1-866-687-7223. Email remains drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. Be back in a couple of minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody, to part two of the Sunday Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston, our guest, Al Globus, and we have a caller on the line, Al. And hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
This is Marshall. I'm back down in Dallas.
Hi, Marshall. How you doing?
Just fine. My question is related to the space weather and the fact that the sun has these solar flares that literally can cook a goose. It's kind of like, well, the radiation on a typical day is not that bad, but whenever these prominences, flares burst, the radiation can triple, quadruple. I think the worst case is like 10 times normal. I presume that you're planning that there be kind of like radiation shelters to everybody evacuates to so that they can protect themselves from these big spikes.
Okay, when you have a solar storm, solar flare or whatever, most of what you get is protons. Okay, so they're not very heavy. That makes them much easier to stop or deflect.
Yeah,
I am not sure how much of a typical solar storm or a typical flare that comes our way gets into zero inclination orbit. I don't have a way of figuring that out. Okay. Now I will note that it doesn't happen very often. Really, yeah. Large flares that that are aimed at Earth, because most of them just don't hit Earth, don't happen a lot. And so I'm not sure that you need to deal with them, but if you do need to deal with them, my favorite way is to have a cylindrical settlement. This is Kalpana 1 I'm describing now. The cylindrical settlement, and take Heppenheimer's idea of having a swimming pool around the axis of rotation, maybe 10 or 20 meters out. So it's pretty low G, but enough to keep the water in. Okay, now water is an excellent an excellent shielding material.
Right.
So the idea is, if there is a solar flare that is dangerous, and you have to, and there's some reason to believe that the magnetic field will not protect you, then everybody has to go swimming.
Yep, and, I like that.
And these storms last on the order of hours to days. Even if they last days, when you pass behind the Earth, you will have a period of 10 or 20 minutes where you can leave the shelter and go get the toy that you forgot. your kid is screaming about it and you're mortified. But I think that's one way to deal with it. What really needs to happen, of course, is to do the analysis to figure out if it's actually a problem. I don't know, and that would be an interesting study to do. I don't know how to figure it out either, but I'm sure it can be done.
Yeah. The other part of that is I kind of remember the early people on ISS talking about there being little flashes in their eyes, and somebody came in with the fact that gamma rays are coming in and hitting the surface and producing subatomic particles, and they had a distance that they could travel before they disintegrated, and they were literally seeing that, which didn't show up on the radiation detectors.
I would be a little surprised if it was gamma rays. I could be wrong. I would think that it would be more likely to be galactic cosmic rays, particularly high energy, high Z, very massive particles like iron nuclei.
Yeah.
that is actually, you know, if you break down the radiation threats, there's the solar radiation, like flares and storms. There's trapped particles in the Van Allen belts, but those are pretty easy. Both of those are pretty easy to stop. And the other is these galactic cosmic rays. Now, galactic cosmic rays come at every size, you know, from electrons and protons all the way up to iron nuclei, and they come in every possible direction and every possible energy because they're produced, you know, outside of the sun. The ones that are dangerous, the ones that make it through the Earth's magnetic field to this orbit, are high energy, you know, relativistic heavy ions like iron. And I believe, although I have to, you know, research this and nail it down, but I think that is the source of the flashes the Apollo astronauts observed, or at least believed to be the source of the ones. This is the first time I've heard about station. And gamma rays, I don't know, maybe. I would think that maybe it's more likely to be a GCR, galactic cosmic rays, but I could be wrong about that.
Would the galactic cosmic rays be something pretty close to a constant, I think?
Well, they are modulated by the Earth, by the sun's magnetic field. So when the sun is magnetically active, there are fewer of them. And when the sun is magnetically inactive, relatively, there are more in Earth orbit. And for the studies that we did with Ulteris, we chose a period when the sun's magnetic energy was very low because we wanted to get a conservative assessment of the radiation. In other words, we wanted the radiation figures that we got from our calculations to be as high as reasonably possible, and that meant choosing a time when the sun's energy were low. So most of the time, the numbers that we provide in our paper are pessimistic. Things will actually be better than that.
Okay. Thank you for the fun.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call.
Bye.
Thank you, Marshall. And listeners, that opens the line up if you would like to give us a call today. 1-866-687-7223. And you have Alexander, and Alexander's in Tucson. And he said, assuming that you could have these LEO settlements, is it possible over the equator for one of them to go into the business of having space solar power stations and beaming the power back to Earth for a profit?
That would be great. I haven't sat down and analyzed it, but it is something that you might want to do. Now, you probably want to build a satellite that co-orbits with you. Because, remember, we need to rotate so that our kids will grow up strong, and that causes a lot of problems. Nothing you can't solve, but it does cause a lot of problems for big, massive solar arrays or other solar collectors. So what you might want to do is, instead of modifying the settlement, you might want to have a co-orbiting space solar power and beaming. Now, if you're at 500 kilometers, the thing you have to worry about with space solar power is you're only able to see a site on Earth for a few minutes. So, a bunch of power comes in, and then 5 or 10 minutes later, it stops. And that's not impossible to deal with, but it is difficult to deal with, which is why most designs for space solar power satellites go to geosynchronous, because then the receiver is getting energy continuously. Now, if you could put many satellites in, say, a 500-kilometer orbit, and people have looked at this much more detail than I have, then you might be able to get a situation where you could get a receiver continuously illuminated by different satellites as they pass over. But that doesn't work until you have enough satellites in orbit that you have continuous or nearly continuous coverage. So the short story is, yes, there are ways that these settlements could contribute to space solar power. Exactly how you want to do it is not clear to me, and it's not something that I have studied extensively.
Okay. We have another caller on hold.
Okay.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you, please?
Hi. This is Doug Plata from Southern California.
Okay.
Hi, Doug.
Hey, Al. How's it going?
Good. Good. What's up?
Hey, first of all, I'd just like to sort of thank you for your work on this, because I think you've probably made some pretty significant contributions two space settlement by, you know, especially your discovery about the reduced radiation at 500 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have a question about artificial gravity. I sort of wanted to experience it myself, and so there's a local theme park that has a gravitron, one of these rides you get in and it spins you around and it sort of slides you up the wall.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, this thing was cooking. It was 24 RPMs, actually.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And 4.5 meters is what I estimated from the center to my head. And so my calculations are that I was experiencing 2.9 Gs, and boy, it sure felt that way.
Uh-huh.
But I only had about 3 minutes, and one thing I was wanting to do is to see, would I be able to, possibly fall asleep if later I was able to ride on it for, 15 minutes. And my experience was really sort of surprising, and it sort of affected my thinking about artificial gravity. My experience was that when I turned my head left and right, of course, at 24 RPMs, I had this horrendous sense of the Coriolis effect. I mean, it was really disconcerting. But the thing is when I laid my head back and closed my eyes and I did the up and down movement of my head, I don't think I experienced any Coriolis effect. It's only when I turned my head left and right.
Right.
Do you know enough about the Coriolis effect? Is that correct? Did I recall correctly?
Okay, I always get confused. But also, data trumps theory. If you moved your head up and down and you didn't feel any Coriolis effects, you most likely didn't feel any Coriolis effects, right? And then we have to go back and figure out why that is in theory.
Right.
Now, what you experienced is about four times the maximum radiation, the maximum rotation that we suggest in our paper. I did a paper with Theodore Hall, who's a real expert in this field, on rotation, where we came up with this 4 RPM. So for the settlement, we're talking about at least a factor of four, maybe a factor of six slower rotation, and we're talking about a radius of rotation on the order of 25 to 56 meters.
Right.
And that will reduce the effects a great deal. And there's one other fact. There's not been a lot of data on this, but there is some. First, they took, I think, five Skylab astronauts, I believe it was five, and they put them in a rotating chair on Earth, and they rotated them up, and they went through a whole protocol, and they got sick. They put that same chair, not the same atoms, but the same design, in Skylab, and they rotated the guys to the same protocol, and they didn't get sick. Radically lower effect. And then when they got back home, they put them in the chair again, and they rotate them in the same protocol, and they got sick again. Now, the reason for this is probably that when you're rotating on the ground, you have a much more complex job for your otolith function. The otoliths are the organs that sense gravity and rotation and accelerations. And on Earth, if you're rotating, you've got the Earth's gravitational field and the rotation that your brain has to sort out.
Right.
The reason you get sick is your brain looks at these signals coming from the ear and goes, what is that? I better make him sick so he'll stop it. Right? And when you're in free space, when you're in orbit, the gravitational component goes away. So it's a much simpler environment. Now, that result has been duplicated on a Vomit comet, but it hasn't been duplicated on large numbers of subjects. So I would put it still in the preliminary thing, but what it says is, the rotation rates that we're talking about, 4 to 6, are conservative. They are more likely to work well than we think they will, based on the data. Because almost all the data behind that comes from people rotating on Earth, anywhere up to about 10 RPM. There was one study at 23 RPM, so there was one study almost at the rates that you were looking at. But most of the studies are much slower rotation.
So I'm thinking about on a trip to Mars, for exploration purposes. I was thinking, you tether out a tether out to a certain distance, you spin up the craft, and spin stage on one end and craft on the other end.
Yeah.
But based on my experience in the gravitron, I began wondering whether you could actually have the crew during their sedentary time, like when they're sleeping or working on the computer, whether you could have them spin in a much shorter but much faster RPMs, so long as you fix their head, so that you could give them as much as 1G, but it's just that they're not moving around.
Well, there's a couple of things. Yes, when you do motion, head motion makes you can still get sick without head motion if you rotate fast enough.
Right.
But if you do head motion, you'll get sick a lot quicker. But people adapt. That's really the central finding, is that people adapt to in the raising of 4 to 6 RPM, which is what we were interested in, within a few hours or a day or two. If you're a particularly susceptible individual, and there is large variations in susceptibility between people, at 6 RPM, you may be sick for a few days. That's quite possible. But most of the population isn't. Even at 4 RPM, susceptible individuals will probably get, feel okay in a day or so. So that's one thing. The other thing to watch out for is that bed rest is a pretty good analog of micro-G.
Right.
In fact, when people try to study micro-G on Earth, the way they do it is with head down, slightly head down bed rest.
Right.
So, putting somebody in a high gravitational field when they're laying down probably doesn't buy you very much. I mean, it's something that needs to be investigated, but the hypothesis going in is it's not very helpful.
Well, it depends on the orientation of the subject relative to the axis of rotation.
Oh, well, if you were effectively standing up, as far as the artificial gravity is concerned, yes, you're absolutely correct.
One final question about your 500 kilometer settlement. What about orbital debris?
We have to fix it.
is that a
the peak of the orbital debris? The largest number of particles is around 800 kilometers. And the way that stuff is going to get cleaned out is by slowly being degraded by the residual atmosphere until it returns to the atmosphere. So if you start building a hotel business in LEO, probably at 350, 400 kilometers or 300 or something like that, or if you have a settlement at 450, 500 kilometers, because you don't want them to come down too quickly, all that debris, about a third of it was generated by the Chinese satellite test and a dead Russian satellite smashing into an iridium sat. All that debris is going to pass right through the region that we're talking about. And the probability of getting hit is not as encouraging as one might hope.
Mm-hmm.
The International Space Station has to dodge one a year, with their criteria being 1 in 10,000 chance of getting hit. But the amount of debris at 400 kilometers is much smaller than at 780 and 800, and all that debris is coming through town. So
right.
For this to work, we're probably going to need to do significant cleanup of LEO orbital debris. And that is arguably the hardest thing to do, because if hotels are profitable, you can just sort of sit back and let the market go, right? But there's really hard to create a market for orbital debris that somehow gets it cleaned up. It's probably just going to take a bunch of government money.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, Alan. Again, I appreciate your work.
Okay, take care of yourself.
Thank you, see you soon. Listeners, the line, we still have time if you want to give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. You got another note from Adrian, who is still sort of challenging you.
And, good for him.
And here he's quoting from Phil Platt's Bad Astronomy article, which he gives me the URL for, but it's too long to give out. On December 24th, 2004, the Earth was rocked by a cosmic blast so epic its scale is nearly impossible to exaggerate. The flood of gamma and X-rays washed over Earth was detected by several satellites designed to observe high-energy skies. The enormous wave of fierce energy was so powerful it actually partially ionized the Earth's upper atmosphere, and it made the Earth's magnetic field ring like a bell. Several satellites were actually blinded by the event. And I went ahead and read the whole article, and it was way, way powerful. of an event. And he then concludes his statement and says, so let's have 1 million humans ride a sudden similar event like this in space without any shielding.
There were people in the ISS in 2004. What happened to them? There was no reports that I know of, but that would be a very interesting thing to look at. Now, the ISS, of course, is much less protected than an equatorial orbit from charged particles, but I'm not sure that it makes a big difference with gamma and X-rays. I don't know anything about that event, but it would be very interesting to look at what happened to the ISS at that time, and if the caller is listening, if they wouldn't mind sending me the link, or maybe you could just forward it to me, I will take a look into it and see what the story is.
I will send it to you. I just did a quick dirty look for ISS and solar storm of 2004 to see if I could find it. So the damn thing is reported on all the different news services, but whether I can real quick while I'm talking to you find out what happened to the ISS, I can't tell you that I can do that real quickly.
Right. Well, I mean, I know the ISS was up there. I'm not absolutely positive there were people on it at the time. I don't know. But there's quite a bit of radiation.
No, there were
measuring
people.
Gear.
It's been continuously inhabited for a long, long time now.
Yeah. So obviously the astronauts were not killed. It would be interesting to see what the radiation monitors on the ISS recorded and exactly what happened.
Adrian, if you're still listening and you can quickly tell us what happened on the ISS, I would appreciate it because I can't find it real quickly, and therefore I can't answer the question, but I think it would be interesting. And I'm going to forward Adrian's email with the link in it to you.
Now, I do want to bring up one point. Living in space is going to be dangerous. Okay? It's going to be a lot more dangerous than living in Santa Cruz, California, which is where I live. Okay? There is no way around that. What this paper says is that the radiation portion of that damage, of that danger, doesn't look nearly as bad as we thought it was. And therefore, we can get away with much less mass. But there are lots of things in space that can kill you. Okay? There are a few things that, by going into space, will not kill you. If you go into one of these little teeny settlements 100 meters across, the chance of you dying in an auto accident is basically zero, whereas the chance of you dying in an auto accident in the United States today is somewhere around 1%. That's a significant drop. There are other things that, you know, happen on Earth that are not likely to happen much on a space station, but overall, you're going to be exposed to more risk. And the important thing is to understand that risk and minimize that risk, but it doesn't mean we give up the dream. Okay? Yes, it's going to be risky. Yes, some people are going to die. Everything of value that has ever been done on this planet has, not everything, but very nearly everything that has ever been done by humanity on this planet involved risk, and there were people that died. So the issue is not to get to zero risk. The issue is to get to an acceptable level of risk that isn't too much higher than being on Earth. And exactly what too much means varies from person to person. And the people who are most likely to go are the people who are most likely to accept larger amounts of risk, because it will be risky. No matter where you go, the moon, Mars, Earth orbit, there's going to be danger.
Adrian, or anybody out there, if you are trying to find out what happened to the ISS in 2004, I would also like you to try to find out how much notice Earth got that storm was on its way. So did we have 3 days? Did we have 1 hour? What was the notice we had where satellites could turn their direction, you know, power down, do things to protect themselves? Because usually there's a period of a notice you get that this thing is headed your way. So it'd be great if we could find out what that period was. What is happening policy-wise to make any of what we've talked about over the last 90 minutes become real life?
Well, the U.S. government is assisting in the development of launch, privately owned, commercially operated launch vehicles that can take people into space. And that is the key to the whole tourism approach. Okay? If you don't have a launch vehicle that can get your tourists into space, you have no space tourism industry. And if I'm right, that is the path to get from where we are to get to that first settlement. So they're doing a lot with regard to that. The key piece is being developed. The second thing is that the Alliance for Space Development is lobbying within Congress with some success for the policy that I described earlier of we're going to have some sort of COTS-like program to develop space stations, commercially owned, privately operated space stations, which look a whole lot like hotels if you get the science agreement out. Now, that particular effort is not going as well as some of the other efforts that the Alliance is doing, but it is making some progress. Also, the notion that, you know, right now, NASA does not have the charter, does not have the congressional direction to focus on settlement. That is not NASA's job, not according to current law. And the Alliance for Space Development, along with its partners and his, is trying to change that. And it would be very helpful, I know, from being in meetings in NASA, to be able to say, hey, you know, we are supposed to be settling space. That is part of our charter. That is part of what we're supposed to do, because you can't say that right now. So that would be very helpful. So we're making progress. Oh, debris is getting more attention. People are doing things to remediate debris. And, of course, launch vehicle development, which is the big one.
Do you think a new administration, which will come in 2017, is likely to make bold, big changes in these directions?
Well, I know that I'm a minority in the space industry, but I think the Obama administration has been terrific for space settlement. And if you go onto my website, you will see a couple of articles about Obama's space policy and space settlement. Now, at the time, I had just finished a paper called Paths to Space Settlement, which basically said that the paths to space settlement are tourism, space solar power, and planetary protection. And if you looked at Obama's proposal for American space policy, not after it got hacked up by Congress, but before it got hacked up by Congress, it was really good from that perspective. It called for developing the commercial crew program, which is happening, which is developing privately owned, commercially operated vehicles that can take people into space, an absolutely essential requirement for tourism. So they're big, big help on tourism. They proposed a 5-year period of technology development followed by the development of a heavy launch vehicle, and that was not accepted. Instead, Congress said, no, we don't want to wait and do technology development and then take the best technology. We want to take the shuttle technology and use it, whether it's the best or not. Okay, so we lost that one. But the original policy had this period where the shuttle would lose its political influence, but then a trade would be done, and shuttle technology that made sense could have been incorporated into that. Didn't happen. Okay, but in any case, you need heavy lift launch for space solar power. You need to lift a lot of stuff any way you look at it, and that's a big, big plus for space solar power. And third, over the course of his administration, he has increased the funding for planetary defense by a factor of 8, okay, usually requesting more than Congress will give. So looked at it from the perspective of paths to space settlement, my ideas about this at the time, it was a brilliant policy. It was near term, but everything it did, or most of what it did, advanced space settlement. So it's, you know, I've certainly, you know, the main thing I want out of the next administration to be is at least as good, or maybe not too much worse, than the Obama administration has been, because I think the Obama administration has done a very good job if your criteria is space settlement. if your criteria is to go to the moon or Mars, well, I'll let you argue about whether it was good or bad, but that's not what I'm trying to do.
Emmett sent in an email. I forget where he is. But he did get at least the basics of what happened. He said from a 2004 CNN article, apparently reprinted from space.com, quote, astronauts aboard the ISS took cover multiple times in protected areas, end quote.
Oh, okay, so the swimming pool solution is the right one for that.
Well, I don't know what the solution was, but I just pulled up the article, and let's see if I can do a search for ISS and see if they actually would be willing to say more than just what Emmett quoted.
Well, it sounds like we got nailed by a solar storm. It sounds like that radiation levels in LEO were sufficient that the astronauts had to take cover. Now, maybe they were passing through the South Atlantic anomaly. That would actually fit the data. Because if they had to go in and out, I mean, the storm doesn't stop and start. Of course, you know, you go around the backside of the Earth. It's hard to tell. I had to look at right where the orbit was. But the short story is they went to certain better protected areas of the ISS, and they were fine. Now, the ISS is nowhere. There's no place on the ISS that is well protected as 5 or 10 meters of water. Okay, shielding. Not even in the ballpark. So maybe even 1 or 2 meters of water. So if you have a swimming pool that is at least 6 feet deep all the way around, you get two meters of water. That's a lot of water. And that is probably sufficient. If it's not, then put more water and, have a deeper swimming pool.
Except water weighs an awful lot.
Yeah, but it's a relatively small amount of space. You know, you're not covering the entire hull with, 4, 5, 6, 7 tons of material. You're covering a small cylinder in the middle, just big enough to fit a couple hundred people.
And of course, it comes in omnidirectional, so you have to be...
No, solar storms are not omnidirectional. Solar storms come from the sun.
But doesn't the radiation come omnidirectional?
Galactic cosmic rays are omnidirectional. They come from every direction, but they originate outside of the solar system.
Right, I'm aware of that.
And actually, during solar storms, I would expect GCR to be lower because that's an aspect of solar magnetic activity, but I'm not sure about that.
Listeners, I'll try to find a more detailed analysis of what happened on the ISS during this 2004 storm, and if I can find it quickly, I will put the URL to that in the archive summary of the show. And maybe somebody wrote more information about what they did, where they took cover, how long, how much warning they had. I'm sure the ISS people had to be given a warning to go get into shelter, right?
Yeah, they must have seen the storm coming.
Yeah, so how much warning did they have? And is the warning to the ISS about the same as the warning to us here on Earth? It probably wouldn't be much different, I would
imagine. Not a whole lot different. We're talking 400 kilometers.
Yeah. What else should we have asked you or talked about today that we've either skipped, omitted, or forgotten about?
Now, there's a good question. I wonder what it is.
Well, you're the boss. You tell me.
I'm going down to the conclusions bit of my paper, of our paper, actually. Sorry about that. I want to talk about extraterrestrial mining because I have touched on this, but I haven't really gotten into it a little bit.
Okay.
Now, remember, the whole basis of this thing is we looked at those studies done in the 70s, which everybody has been taking for more or less gospel ever since, and we looked at certain assumptions that those studies made. And it turns out, and the work of these studies is fabulous work. I'm not criticizing the people at all. But it was done a long time ago, and we know more than we do now. Than we did then. And it turns out that some of those assumptions were false. It turns out there's reasons of space, almost certainly, they're not for sure, the radiation levels are very low. It turns out that you can rotate permanent resonance quite a bit faster than we thought. And by the way, that comes from a careful survey of the literature. And there's a paper online that has that same space.alglobus.net website. So we found out that some of these assumptions were wrong, and as a result, you want to put the space settlement 760 times closer to Earth, and you need a very small fraction of the mass, maybe 200 times like less mass. Okay? Now, when you do that, the need for extraterrestrial mining goes away because you're much less massive and you're farther away from the moon and closer to Earth. Okay? So what that takes a massive piece out of the critical path. But it doesn't mean you don't want to mine the moon. It just means, or the asteroids, it just means you want to do it a little bit later when the space settlements have a market to develop. Another thing that I wanted to bring up, it occurred to me as I was talking about, is the caveats. For the radiation, most of the studies of radiation that we used to for our paper and to come to our conclusions, most of them were not galactic cosmic rays. Galactic cosmic rays are by far the hardest to shield from, and if you shield from galactic cosmic rays, the high energy, high mass ones, you will shield for everything else easily. So if you can take care of GCR, you don't have to worry very much about a bunch of protons from, you know, trapped in the radiation belts or coming from the sun. They're just so much, you know, it's like ping pong balls, and the GCR is a rifle bullet, right? The ping pong balls will get taken care of. So the studies that were done, most of the studies that we looked at did not use GCR. And there's things you can do to make, you know, biological equivalent. That's the whole idea behind millisieverts is a measure of biological effectiveness, but that's not necessarily completely correct in every possible way. So there is uncertainty in the actual biological effect of radiation in the chosen orbit, 500 kilometers, give or take a bit, equatorial. So we need a research program that will nail down the effect on biota of radiation in this environment. Now, there's some stuff we can do on the ground. You can irradiate rodents with the right sort of radiation at Brookhaven National Lab. And, in fact, my sister does that because she's a NASA biologist. I'm a contractor. She actually works for NASA. There is a problem with that, however. It's impractical to irradiate rodents for weeks on end in order to give them that low dose of radiation over long periods of time. So what they do is they dose the rodents with a whole bunch of radiation all at once and then hope that that mimics the effect of spreading it out. Well, we know that spreading the radiation out is a lot less damaging than if you get a whole bunch of radiation at once. But still, you can do some work on the ground, and you can take a look at a few things. And I've actually sort of looking at the parameters of studying rodent pregnancy, because that's the thing that's the most worrying in this radiation environment. The second thing you could do is you could go onto the International Space Station. Now, the radiation environment there is much more severe than in our chosen orbit, but we already have a facility there, and it already has rodent facilities. It already has a glove box so that you can work on the rodents and so forth. The thing it doesn't have is a centrifuge to allow us to say, oh, the effects that we're seeing were caused by the radiation, not by the G level. Okay? But right now we can't say that, and furthermore, as I've indicated earlier, it's really hard to keep rodents alive through multiple generations without a centrifuge because the baby mice, well, I don't know the right term, have a hard time getting nutrients from their mother. Okay, so what we really want and what we will need to do before we actually settle LEO is we need a facility in the right orbit, 400, 500, 600 kilometers, maybe moving around a bit, see how things go, directly over the equator, and in that thing we need a glove box. We need centrifuges, and we need a biologist. Okay, the astronauts are great, but they have to be jack of all trades. They have to be able to maintain the station. They have to be able to do biology experiments. They have to be able to do materials experiments. They have to be able to do human subject. It says there's a lot to know how to do, and so when comes time to sacrifice a rodent and cut them up for pieces for study, it's been 6 months or a year or 2 years since they got that training. Well, I got news for you. It's not that easy to operate on rodents. And if you don't do it, if you haven't done it very much, and it was 2 years ago that last did it, the chances of you messing something up are pretty good. Okay? So we need a biologist who knows the procedures backwards and forwards, has done them hundreds of times, so we can get really good on-orbit data about leash rodents going completely through their life cycle, 2, 3, 4, 5 generations, so that we understand the threat that is posed by the radiation. And that is, you know, a pretty big job to do.
A couple of things here. Adrian sent in another note, which I did forward to you, Al, because he has a link in it. This was no solar storm. It was generated by a cosmic magnetic star surface quake, and the radiation was gamma, so no magnetic shielding would have helped. He gives you the link to it. I read the article real quickly, and it was the biggest thing ever recorded. And it was wild, to say the least, and you'll get the link to that. And now, in terms of rodent, Dr. Charles Lamoli of UC Irvine was a guest on the show Tuesday, so he was the co-author on this paper about what cognitively happens to mice with radiation, and he gave it a tricky name, you know, what happens to your brain on the way to Mars, which got a lot of hits and a lot of support, depending on your point of view and who you talk to. But he explained the rodent experiments and the low doses and over the short period of time and all of that very thoroughly to people who want to hear and understand what happened. I did receive many emails from aerospace medicine doctors who said his extrapolations were absolutely right on. They do this experiment all the time with rodents. And it is possible, because they have a very short life compared to a human, that you can speed up whatever it is you're doing to them as compared to what would happen to a human, because the life cycle of the rodent is so vastly different from that of a human. So you can speed up the low-dose radiation, for example, and still extrapolate fairly accurately what that would mean for a human. The medical people are really good at this, and I must have gotten a dozen emails from aerospace medicine doctors, not just those working in radiation, but across the field, who have experience working with rodents and say this is pretty common medical practice that is being used. And listeners, you can hear the show. It's from Tuesday evening, and his paper, you know, if you have the view of Dr. Zubrin, his paper was garbage and trash. And if you have the view of a scientist and a medical researcher, you probably applaud the paper, so take your pick.
Well, the reason that everybody does that is what's practical. It is not practical,
yeah,
unless you
absolutely
have a lot of money, to irradiate rodents at the level of GCR experienced in low Earth orbit, which, remember,
well,
is much less than on the way to Mars.
Yeah, they can't
okay,
do
wait,
it.
But just wait a second. So the way that a mouse pregnancy lasts, I think, 19 or 20 days. You can't irradiate them continuously for 19 or 20 days. It just doesn't work. It's also really expensive. Brookhaven is $7,000 an hour.
Yeah, and he uses Brookhaven, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great stuff. So what the scientists are doing is the best you can do on ground. You can't do better on ground as a practical matter. And, you know, that's where you can get your data. That's the best you can do. However, there is evidence, pretty good evidence, actually, that when you spread the radiation out, the effects go down, not in all cases. Then this evidence is from rodents, and it's not massive, you know, numbers of studies, but it's a number of studies. And most of those studies work a little different. What they'll do is they'll hit the rodent with a relatively small amount of radiation, wait a little while, hit it with a large amount of radiation, and compare that with a group that only got hit by the large amount of radiation, and the effects are quite a bit less. In other words, the body, I don't know about the brain, the body adapts to the radiation, so when they get the next shot of radiation, they're not as effective.
Well, that's the key, because he's doing brain cognitive studies only,
right,
and the
right.
brain is different than the rest of the body.
Yes, and this is why you need to put a facility in the orbit we're talking about that can raise rodents through multiple generations and look at exactly the sorts of things that he does and see, okay, is this an effect that's just because of the way this experimental design has to be, there's no way to do it better? Or is this an effect that is similar in this orbit as it would be to on the way to Mars, those are definitely open questions, and it's a reason that we need some sort of facility to answer them.
Absolutely.
But a couple of studies on rodents is not definitive. You need to look deeper.
It would be nice to have these facilities on orbit. Any other comments, any other points you want to leave with us, pearls of wisdom?
It would be helpful to do something along the lines of Biosphere 2 to start getting to work on recycling water, air, and solid matter in your food. A lot of people think of Biosphere 2, almost everybody thinks of Biosphere 2 as a failure. And if you measure it in marketing and scientific terms, that's true. In science, it was a failure because in science, you want to vary one thing at a time and see what happens so you really understand it, which is not what they did at all. And from a marketing perspective, they said, we're going to go in and we're going to stay in for 2 years. Well, they actually lasted without resupply, significant resupply, and they actually lasted 13 months. So everybody called them a failure. Well, if they had just been clever enough to say, oh, we're going to go and stay in there for 1 year, then they would have been a success from a marketing perspective. Now, as an engineer, software engineer, sort of not a true engineer, but kind of an engineer, looking at Biosphere 2, and from an engineering perspective, it was fabulous. They were able to get in a closed environment, and we know the gas was closed because they ran out of oxygen. Okay, so we know that they did get it closed. They were able to get six people to survive in a closed environment for over a year on the first try. What I would have expected from something like that was in 3 weeks the whole thing went south and they had to be taken out. But they actually lasted for more than a year. And I suspect, this is a hypothesis, not a result, that the reason is that they had a vast variety of plants and animals in there. And what happened is most of them died off, and the rest of them put together a viable biosystem that was able to survive for over a year and actually made it longer than a year just by being resupplied with oxygen. And, you know, if a space settlement is starting to lose oxygen and you're only 500 kilometers from Earth, you just send some bloody oxygen. If you're on Mars, you have a very serious problem. You better get the, you know, oxygen-producing machine to work again because you can't be resupplied. Okay, so it would be really helpful to do some sort of study like that. And that would be, frankly, helpful for anything you want to do in space. It would be, if you believe in Martian space settlements, it's helpful. If you want to do lunar space settlements, it's helpful. If you just want to go to Mars, it's, you know, as an exploration base, it's helpful. This would be a really, you know, have an engineering facility which develops the ability to build, to have people live in closed environments for, you know, multi-year periods. And you can change out crew. It's not a big deal if you change out the crew after 6 months. It doesn't break the validity of your experiment at all. That would also be very helpful. So we'd like to see something like that. We'd like to see a facility that allows us to really nail down the effects of radiation, at least on rodents in that area. We need some sort of program to verify the rotation findings, particularly for the zero-G environment. Some sort of rotating chair for the ISS would do just finely. We need to clean up LEO debris, and we need to determine what the real minimum size is. What our studies of rotation said is that if you rotate at 4 or 5 or 6 RPM, you may have a few hours or a day or two to adjust, and then you will be fine. What it doesn't say is if it's viable to live in something that's only 50 meters across or 100 meters across. That rotation doesn't stop you, but something else very much may. And these results of reducing the fat mill by a factor of 200, you know, we might lose a factor of 20 or something like that, or 10 or 5, depending on how small we can build the facility, and we really don't know how small we can get away with. Maybe we'll figure that out in the course of the hotels, because a hotel doesn't have just visitors, it also has staff, okay? And, you know, how viable is it for staff to live for 5 years, for 3 years, for 2 years? We don't know. Maybe that will be helpful. But we do need to determine what that minimum size is, and we need to determine which factors influence that minimum size, because we don't really know.
A lot of work to do, Al.
As always.
Get with it.
But probably 200 times less work than we thought.
Well, still a lot of work.
Yes.
A lot of work. I look forward to talking to you next week in San Jose at New Space. And listeners, if you're going, look him up. He'll be there. And he's easy to see and easy to find. And look me up and say hello. And, you know, it would be fun to visit with you at New Space next week if, for those of you that are going to go there. Al, thank you very much for joining us again. And we will do this far more often than what it took from 2008 to get here in 2015. And I look forward to talking to you some more on the space show.
Take care.
You too. And when I get it archived, I will send you all the location information and where it is so you can use the show or hear it or, you know, hide from it if you want to.
I'll probably put a link to it from my settlement page.
Please do. And we'll look forward to talking to you soon. And listeners, now, special timing this week. So Monday's show is 7 p.m. California time, and Tuesday's show is 2 p.m. It's like we have a polar reversal here of space show program. So Monday is Doug Plata, and I'm going to post one of his papers on the topic he's going to discuss tomorrow on the space show blog after today's program is archived. So before you listen to the show tomorrow night at 7 p.m. California time, please go to the blog and read his 11-page paper, okay? And then Tuesday, we have a gentleman, Jack Burns, from the University of Colorado and NASA, who does lunar exploration work and lunar exploration of the cosmos work. And he's at the University of Colorado in Boulder, and it should be a very interesting program. No show on Friday, no show on Sunday because of the New Space Conference. When we come back Monday on the 20th, what do we always do every year on July 20th? Rand Sinberg and Bill Simon come back, and they do Ebola Terra with us. And we're going to do that again this year. I really like the ceremony. I think it's worth doing. And, you know, it's a great time to discuss the significance of July 20th. So Rand and Bill will be with us on Monday the 20th. Thank you all for listening. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. Have a terrific weekend coming up. See you at New Space. Goodbye from Al Globus and the Space Show.